idea behind Twelve Things God Can't Do is to actually to see God's greatness in bigger print than we sometimes do. To take the things that are true about God that maybe we sort of know, and to bring them out into the light, and to sort of gaze on them and to think together, and to wonder and to worship. I don't know what you thought when you saw the sort of title for our sort of series of talks together, 12 Things God Can't Do. Ollie and I were just having a little sort of post-breakfast walk before the meeting, and we wandered into the church, which is a fascinating little church building, and it's got some really exquisite sculptures in it. And we noticed that they were behind railings, so you couldn't open them. And we went over to the other side, and the railings kind of creaked open as we pressed on them. We thought, let's go through here. And then there was a staircase. We thought we had to go up there. I don't know. But we'll go up, and if the door at the top's locked, then obviously we're not supposed to go through. So we got up to the top, and I turned the handle, and the door opened. And it was a Sunday school room. No secret treasures or anything like that, but fascinating. Right there in front of us, written in red pen on a couple of sheets of A4 paper and stuck on the front of the Lego box, were the words to a song. And that song is, "My God is so big, so strong and so mighty." There's... Right. I've no idea, is that a sign? So we're used to that idea, aren't we, that God can do anything. There's nothing that God cannot do. But actually, when you think about it, there are actually things that would be better if God couldn't do. It would be better, wouldn't it, if God couldn't be evil. If God couldn't turn away from what is good. And indeed, the Bible does tell us he can't. James chapter 1 tells us God cannot even be tempted by evil. Evil has no pull on him. He's not attracted to him. He hates it. It would be better, wouldn't it, if God couldn't lie, if God would always tell the truth. Well, the book of Hebrews tells us God, it's impossible for God to lie. And there are lots of things the Bible tells us God can't do. And they are things that actually make God better than a God who could just do anything. So the Bible does tell us repeatedly that there is no rival power to God, that there's nothing that God wants to do that he cannot do, in the sense that, you know, God, if God sets his mind to doing something, if God tries, nothing can resist. But that's not quite the same as being just completely able to do anything. Kind of, I think about that idea of being able to just do anything as being like a kind of... we have a dog who's slightly unpredictable. We inherited her when she was 7, and she's a cockapoo. I don't know if any of you have cockapoos or have come across cockapoos, but they're half poodle. And poodles they can do anything. In the sense that you don't know from 1 minute to the next whether you know, you'll be licked or bitten. It's not quite that bad. And if you ever come to visit us, I promise you our dog won't bite you. But, you know, actually someone who can just do anything in any moment is unpredictable and unsafe. But God is not unpredictable. He will always do what is right and what is best. Another thing that's great about realising that is that you realise that a lot of the sort of proofs of God's non-existence that you sort of come across if you listen to someone like Richard Dawkins. He's used this example. You know, he says, so the Christian definition of God is that he is all-powerful, right? He's omnipotent, he can do anything. Well, can he make a rock that's too heavy for him to lift? Which is a brilliant question if you think that God being all-powerful means he can literally just do anything, isn't it? Because if you say no to that question, you've just said, well, the God who can do everything doesn't exist, because here's something you can't do. You can't make a rock that's too heavy for him to lift. Right, so okay, well, that's the other way. You can make a rock that's too heavy for him to lift. Oh, but then something you can't do there, isn't there? So it logically doesn't make any sense to have that idea of a God who is just completely unbounded, where there's literally nothing you can't do. Logically, it doesn't nothing that he wants to do that he cannot do. Nothing, no one, no power in all of creation can stand against him. He's all powerful in that sense. But being all powerful is not quite the same as being able to do anything, because you can't lie, you can't do evil, you can't be tempted, all those sorts of things. God is actually better than the song suggests. Because my God is so good, so strong, so mighty, there are 12 things that he cannot do. And we're going to think about some of them together. But before we dig into those, I want us just to reflect on what God is like in kind of like zooming right out and looking at the big picture. And one of the great passages for that is Isaiah chapter 40. If you've got the church Bibles in front of you, we're on page 600. And I'm just going to start reading at verse 12. And as I read, I want you to have three questions. Am I right? Page 600, Isaiah 40, verse 12. And they all say, yeah, good, excellent. So as I read from verse 12 through to the end of the chapter, I want you to ask these three questions. And then do you ask them? I know there are some people who say, well, if you ask me to do something, what do you mean? I'm not going to do it. Because that's just the kind of person I am. You'll regret it, because I want you then to split into groups of two or three in order to discuss those questions, so if you haven't thought about them, more for you. But also just to say, you might be the sort of person who just really hates talking in a small group in a situation like this. It's fine, just sit there with your arms folded, looking unhappy, and no one will talk to you, and you can just let other people get on with small group work. Totally fine if you want to kind of withdraw from that. But good to talk if you can. Right, that's enough of that. So, three questions. What is God like? What does God know? And how does God know what God knows? Okay, what is God like? What does God know? And how does God know what God knows? Let's listen together to God's words from Isaiah chapter 40. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and marked off the heavens with a span, enclosed the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales, and the hills in a balance? Who has measured the Spirit of the Lord, or what man shows him his counsel? Whom did he consult, and who made him understand? Who taught him the path of justice, and taught him knowledge, and showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket, and are accounted as the dust on the scales. Behold, he takes up the coastlands like fine dust. Lebanon would not suffice for fuel, nor are its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are counted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. So whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness compare with him? An idol? A craftsman casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and casts for it silver chains. He who is too impoverished for an offering chooses wood that will not rot. He seeks out a skillful craftsman to set up an idol that will not move. Do you not know? Do you not hear? Has it not been told to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundation of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain, and spreads them like a tent to dwell in. It brings princes to nothing, and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely is their stem taken root in the earth, when he blows on them and they wither. And the tempest carries them off like stubble. To whom one will you compare me, that I should be like him, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high and see. Who created these? He who brings out their host by number, calling them all by name, by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God?
Almighty God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. But they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Three questions. What is God like? What does God know, and how does he know it? They are, if you're not folding your arms and looking aside, you can get into groups of two or three just to discuss those questions for a couple of minutes.
Okay, let's come back together. Just fair warning, as we feedback, I'm going to ask you to just point us to a verse for your answers. So if you want to say one of the things that you've noticed about what God is like as you have looked at Isaiah 40, as we share with the group, just to sort of point us to a verse. I don't want to catch you off guard with that. You know, first person puts their hand up and says something, which is brilliant. And I say, where do you get that from? And they sort of feel crushed. So we don't want that. So what is God like from Isaiah 40? What's he like? Yes, please. Huge. Where do you get that? Fantastic, thank you. So, huge and actually kind of incomparable with the creation. So that the things that, take the things that you think are biggest, and God makes them look really tiny. So the oceans of the earth. If you've ever travelled on a big sea, you know just how sort of powerful and huge the oceans are. They cover most of the earth's surface. There's just an unimaginable amount of water, and even the biggest things we build sort of container ships and all the things that feel like towns when you see them. They're just huge. If you see one in port, it's just mind-bogglingly large. But then if you see it on the ocean in a big storm, it's like a cork being tossed around on a bathtub. You know, the sea is just so powerful. And so you see, we live in Hove, which is just on the sea, and there are times in the year when the whole beach just gets washed up off the beach and onto the promenade, and they have to get the bulldozers in to push it all back. Just one winter storm, and we don't really have sand, so that's part of the problem for us. It's all shingle, and it's just piled up. You know, it's 20 feet above where it normally is. And, like, if we tried to do that together, if we made that our group project for the weekend, we said, let's jump in the cars and get out of there, and we'll shift the beach up onto the promenade, we'd be exhausted and we'd achieve nothing. But the sea does it in a minute. And yet, Isaiah says to God, all the waters on the earth, it's just like, you know, I don't know if you ever did this as a kid in the bath, trying to see how much water you can actually hold in your hand without it sort of dribbling between your fingers. You ever do that? God does that with all the water in the world, and it's just there in the palm of his hand. He's got the waters in the palm of his hand. And mountains are like the sort of biggest mountain. If you've never left the UK, you've never really seen a mountain, have you? But, you know, if you've travelled and if you've seen mountains, there's a reason that they were the sort of great focus of a lot of ancient religions. The idea was that the gods lived at the top of the mountains. They were sort of holy, kind of rather forbidding places, because they're huge, they're immovable. You know, the idea that you can move a mountain is a joke. And yet God sort of weighs them on a little scale. Like a pharmacist, which is like a legal drug dealer, just weighing out the mountains. So he is just vast. Thank you. Anything else? What else? Yes, please. Incomparable. Thank you. Where do you get that from? Verse 18. Brilliant. So, So actually, when we ask the question, what is God like, the basic answer to that question is, he's not like anything. There is nothing else in existence that is actually like him. So he's incomparable in terms of scale. The universe is tiny next to him. He's incomparable in terms of holiness. So, you know, why would you compare an idol to him? Idols are things that human beings make. Isaiah's writing satire here, isn't he? Saying, as for an idol, a craftsman makes it. It's something that a human being has made. It ain't God. That's an interesting question, isn't it? It ain't God. Isaiah basically says that if you're too poor to make a big metal statue with silver chains to hold it in place, you get a wood carver who can make something that won't fall over. That's the sort of idea with idols. And yet, God is the one who makes everything stand up. So he's incomparable in terms of holiness and worship. I just love this in verse 16. Lebanon would not suffice for fuel. What does that mean? Lebanon, right, is kind of the most fertile place that Isaiah can think of. It's beautiful and known for its majestic trees. I think, in fact, through there you might be able to see a cedar of Lebanon. Okay. They're kind of related, I think they're related to giant redwoods. They're huge trees. They smell fantastic. They're beautiful. You can cut a giant redwood tree down, cut a cedar of Lebanon down, you've got fuel that will probably last you the rest of your life if you're just using a log burner at home to try and sort of keep the energy bills down. Isaiah says, cut down every single cedar in Lebanon. All these majestic, huge trees. Pile them up into a bonfire, reaching the sky. Take every clean, sacrificial animal in Lebanon and sacrifice it. And it's not going to be nearly enough. Lebanon would not suffice for fuel, nor are its beasts enough for a burnt offering. Take the sort of place most bounteous in the things you need for sacrifice, and sacrifice all of it. And it's not enough. For how holy, how majestic, how wonderful God is. In other words, the creation cannot reach up to God. The creation cannot compare with him. And there's an important little nugget that lies sort of buried in that, and I think it might be quite helpful and important for some of us to grab hold of. And it's this. That the God you meet in the pages of Scripture, and the God who speaks of himself in Isaiah chapter 14, and said that Lebanon is not sufficient for fuel, nor is animals enough for burnt offerings. Actually, he's kind of pointing something out about your relationship with him. He doesn't need you. The creation can't give him anything that he doesn't already have. He doesn't need you. And so when God called you to himself, when God called you into his church, when God called you to Grace Church, it wasn't because actually he's feeling a bit short-staffed and what he could really do with is what only you can bring to the table. Okay, he's not interested in you because of what he's going to get from you. But that is different from the people you meet in business, isn't it? Who are interested in you because of what you can give them for, because of what you can offer to the company or to them in terms of their career, like whatever. God doesn't relate to you like that. He doesn't need you. So when he calls you into a relationship with himself, it is not because of what he needs or what you have to give. It is simply because he loves you for your sake. That's the alternative, isn't it? To being interested in you because of what you've got to give him. Actually, he's interested in you because of what he's got to give you. Which is a really
Exodus 3 is on page 46.
His people calling out to him in their distress, in slavery and under oppression, and decides that he is going to intervene. And so one of those babies, Phineas, the Nile, is called Moses, and he's plucked out of the Nile by Pharaoh's daughter and brought up in Pharaoh's own palace. But in God's kind of great wisdom and power, Moses, though he is brought up as a child in Pharaoh's own house, is says to him, you are to go to Pharaoh and tell him, let my people go. Okay. Now, I don't know what you would say if you were asked to go to the most powerful man in the world and ask him to let go of his slave labor force. Moses' response in Exodus chapter 3 is as follows. Sorry, it's quite dark in here. So Moses said to God, chapter 3, verse 11, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? That's Moses' first question. Well, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? And God basically says to Moses, that's the wrong question to ask, Moses. So he says, but I will be with you. So Moses' next question is a much better question, which is basically, okay, then, well, who are you? What name shall I, if I go to the people of Israel and say, you know, the God of your fathers, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has sent me to you, what am I to tell them is your name? And God says this, verse 14. God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, that is, Yahweh, or I am, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. So just as a little side note, that name, I am, Yahweh, is so holy to Jewish people that they won't say it out loud. Say Adonai, which means my Lord or the Lord. And so in our Bibles, you have the Lord written in small capitals whenever that holy name of God is used. Okay? And so whenever you see the Lord in small caps, it's that covenant name, that special name that God gives to Moses by which to know him and by which to introduce him to the people. And that's the name that's being used. So, I am who I am. That's a funny name, isn't it? It's an unusual kind of name. And yet it's a name that tells us something very profound about who God is. And it's sort of what bubbles underneath all the way through Isaiah chapter 40. What is the Lord like? Well, he's not like anything in creation. And actually his relationship to creation is not as a participant in it, it's not as part of it or something that can be compared with it, but is as its maker. He is the source of everything. He is the one from whom all good things come. And everything, when it was made, was good. God made everything. So there are two kinds of thing that exist. things like us, physical things, and supernatural things, spiritual beings. So there's a kind of dividing line in reality between the natural and the supernatural. In Scripture, that is not the basic division of reality. Natural and supernatural all belong within the creation. Angels and demons are as much part of the creation as we are. They depend completely on God for their existence. So that's not the dividing line, natural, supernatural, nor is good and evil. Evil actually is just a twisting of the good. It's not a real kind of existence at all. The dividing line, the two kinds of things that exist are God and things that God has made. Those are the only two kinds of thing in existence. And that's what we call the creator-creature divide. There is a creator and there are creatures. There is nothing else. So, if you exist, you are either God or you are something that God has made. So if you pinch yourself and ask yourself, do I exist? Feels like it. Am I God? Probably not. All of reality doesn't really depend on me. Well, then God made me. That's who I am. That's where I am. Whereas God, so I can't define myself simply on the basis of myself. Because my being is something that's been given to me by another, that's been given to me by God, and actually by all kinds of intermediaries. If it wasn't for my parents, I wouldn't exist. So you can't really discuss my being without talking about the being of my parents, and without talking about the being of their parents. We're all completely dependent on that chain, aren't we? I was talking to a friend a couple of days ago. His grandfather was supposed to be on the Zeebrugge raid in, he was a Royal Marine in the First World War, and was supposed to be on the Zeebrugge raid. And he was withdrawn at the last minute because of ill health. Now, I don't quite know what it was, he may have just had a cold. But anyway, he didn't go on the raid. Pretty much everyone who went on that raid died. And so my friend was sitting there saying, look, if my granddad hadn't got a cold that day, I wouldn't exist. That's the kind of being that we have. It's completely contingent. It's completely dependent on other factors that are outside of ourselves. But God, I am who I am, he says. He exists because of who he is. He's not dependent on anything else. He's not defined by anything else or in relationship to anything else. He just is. And he comes from not anywhere else, but from himself. He doesn't have a beginning or an end. He is timeless. There are all kinds of mind-bending things we could go into, and we'll go into a little bit more over the course of the weekend. But for the moment, we notice this. This is pretty much the only bit of Latin you're getting this morning. But it's a word that people often come across when talking about who God is and what God's nature is, and that is this word arseity, which just means from himself. God is from himself, are from, say, self. Okay? God comes from himself. He is who he is. He doesn't depend on and he's not defined by anything else. He gives himself a name. So idols, human beings get to choose what they like. God gets to decide who he is and what he's like. He names himself. And when he names himself, he says, I am who I am. So we want to be careful, maybe, if we find ourselves saying, well, I like to think of God as being like this. That's probably not a very good idea, is it? It's not how I like to think of God that matters, it's how God likes to think of God that matters. I don't get to choose what he's like. He is who he is. Does that make sense? I'd say. And connected to that is this idea of perfection. Now, when we talk about something being perfect, we normally mean it's flawless, it's really good, you can't find fault with it. But when we talk about God being perfect, we mean a bit more than that. Now, we actually mean that because God is the source of every good thing, he has all goodness in himself. He actually couldn't be better than he is. It's not possible to improve on him. He is perfect in the sense of being complete in every good thing. So if you take anything away from who God is, you make him worse. And if you add anything to who God is, you make him worse. Because he is absolutely and utterly perfect. And this is the quote I've given you from Edward Lee, who was a Puritan theologian. God highest imaginable happiness, the summit of all possible blessedness. God has every imaginable good thing, and more, and is complete in all of them. You could not add to his store of blessing. You could not add to his happiness. God is blessed above all things. And he has no needs. All good things come from him. So in Isaiah 40 we saw, didn't we, that God doesn't grow tired or weary. We see that in Psalm 121, but applied to the people of God. So some of the sense of some on the way to Jerusalem for the festival. Jerusalem is up a big mountain, and it's to walk there, 3,000 years ago was a dangerous thing. There are wild animals, there are criminals lurking by all the mountain passes, and as you walk through, there's that sort of sense of anxiety. And these songs of ascent are songs to sort of encourage each other on the way in the goodness of God. And so here is Psalm 121. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. You see that? What is it about God that the psalmist notes? He is the maker of everything, the maker of heaven, the very highest thing, earth, the very highest thing, everything in between. That God, on whom everything depends, he will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over you. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore. So the encouragement to the people of Israel faced with danger and difficulty, with heat in the day and cold at night, with wild animals, with robbers lining their journey. God doesn't sleep. He is always alert. He is always watching. And so Psalm 3 and 4 are the first two kind of experience psalms in the book of Psalms. Both are psalms that come out of situations of real danger and anxiety, and they both feature this idea. Because God doesn't sleep, we can. So Psalm 3, verse 4. I call out to the Lord, he answers me from his holy mountain. I lie down and sleep. I wake again, because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear any tens of thousands assail me on every side. Or Psalm 4. Many, Lord, are asking, who will bring us prosperity? Let the light of your face shine on us. You filled my heart with joy, more than when there grain and new wine abound. In peace, I will lie down and sleep. For you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety. So the picture is that the believer can sleep in peace because God is always vigilant. God doesn't sleep, so we can. We'll think about Mark chapter 4 at the beginning of the next session, but I just want to read you this very brief quote from Victor Hugo, the author of Les Miserables. This is from a letter to a friend that he wrote in 1841. Have courage for the great sorrows of life, and patience for the small ones. And when you have laboriously accomplished your daily task, go to sleep in peace. God is awake.
Right. Mark chapter 4, verse 35. Page 839. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, let us go across to the other side. And leaving the crowd, they took him with them on the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, teacher, do you not care that we're perishing? And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, peace, be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. He said to them, why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith? And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, who is this that even the wind and the sea obey him. Now, the sleepy Jesus in this story is quite a surprise, but perhaps not for the reason you think initially. So to start with, you see the landlubber, the inland boy, goes on a boat with the hardened fishermen, the people who make their living on the lake or the sea, depending on which gospel you read. Luke calls it a lake, Mark calls it a sea. Anyway, there they go. They're out there. There is this great storm, and all the fishermen are panicking and thinking they're going to drown, and Jesus is sleeping. And that seems like a bit of a surprise. And then there's another surprise, because there's this terrible storm, and these very experienced seafarers turn to the landlubber and say, "What are you going to do about this?" And then what he's going to do becomes clear. He stands up, and which is no mean feat, is it, on a pitching deck, and starts talking to the elements. He says to the wind, "Shh, shh," and to the sea, "Lie down." And it does. And then Jesus turns and he tells off the disciples as well. "Why are you so afraid?" At which point, they become more afraid. So they're terrified because the sea is coming into the boat. The boat is already filling, Mark says. But then they're more scared having Jesus in the boat than they were having the sea in the boat at the end. That's what happens, isn't it? They're filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who is this?" You can trace it through. NIV translation that I put in the handout is actually much less. Those of you who were here last night will be agreeing with my old friend Gilly about the dangers of the NIV. But the ESV translation is much more helpful because it translates the same word the same way throughout. That first appears in verse 37. "And a great windstorm arose." The Greek word is mega. Okay? And we know, don't we, that even if you've never heard a word of Greek in your life, you know what the word mega means, right? It means huge. It's a mega storm. And then you'll notice, end of verse 39, there is a great calm. There's a mega calm. It's not like it just sort of settles. It's mega. It's hugely quiet. And then, as if to sort of emphasize where this story ends up, verse 41, they are filled with a mega fear, a great fear. Why is that? Well, their question explains it, doesn't it? They say, "Who is this? Even the wind and the sea obey him." Who do the wind and the sea obey? There's only one person. Only God himself. The creator can command the elements of the creation, can speak to the wind. Now, I have trouble making myself heard above the wind. Jesus gives instructions to it. Only God can do that. Only God can speak to the raging sea and have it be quiet. And so, they're terrified. More frightened of having Jesus in the boat than having the sea in the boat, because Jesus is the living God. That's the implication of their question. That's where Mark is leading us with this story. That's what Jesus is revealing about himself in speaking to the wind and the waves in this way, is that he is the uncreated creator of everything. He is the one to whom heaven and earth will bow the knee. And it's terrifying for the disciples to realize they're in his presence. As Moses hears from God, "No one may look on me and live." As Isaiah says in Isaiah chapter 6, "Woe is me, I'm a man of unclean lips, I dwell among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the Lord." Sinful people cannot look on God and fail to be destroyed, and yet here they are in the boat with God himself. That's the terrifying realization they come to. and it is more frightening than sinking. At which point, sleepy Jesus becomes even more of a surprise, doesn't it? Because now we're not just surprised that he can sleep through a storm. We're surprised because someone who has the very powers of the living God, the very authority of the living God to command the elements, is sleeping. And I think if we learned something this morning, it was that God doesn't sleep. And so, in Jesus, we have this big question. How can it be that he has all the power and prerogative of divinity, that he really is God? And yet at the same time, there he is, asleep on the boat. And as we'll see at the end of this session, God can't learn, but Jesus goes to school. He had to learn how to write his ABCs. He grew in knowledge. He learned. That's, in one sense, along with all the things that God can't do, we're going to be scratching our heads together a bit this weekend and thinking, but Jesus did those things that God can't do, and yet he is God. So God has done things that God can't do. How and why is that true, and why is that glorious, and why does that actually make the good news of Jesus all the more amazing, the more we're aware of just quite how strange, in one sense, the gospel really is for those of us